Mark said, this is the type of talk you might not otherwise see. And so this talk was intended to be given a little bit later, so we'll have to either adjust the background or make some assumptions. So it reminds me of one of the greatest lines I've ever heard from the great mathematician Harry Furstenberg, who, when introducing very esoteric mathematics, begins with, recall if you did not already know that. Okay, so let's start with the slideshow. Okay, so I'm going to be talking really today more about methodology. This is joint work with Ronan Schul and Mauro Maggioni. So let's see, there's a PDF of what I'm going to be talking about on Ronan Schul's homepage here at UCLA in the math department. So this I consider sort of the lowest possible level of application. So this is really what you do before you do what you want to do. So this is really a method of manipulating data that might appear, and we'll see some short allusions to how this might be used in the types of problems being discussed in this workshop. But I should point out that this, I think, is something that's really pretty early in its infancy, and we'll have to see exactly how useful these methodologies are. But there's a general type of principle, which is to reduce your data to the simplest possible form so that one may then proceed. And of course, simplest possible form is not what you would do if you did the simplest possible thing. Those are quite different. And this brings us to our other announcement. It's Mark Green's birthday! Happy birthday, Mark! So this is also, it's not just a birthday, this is one of these really important birthdays. He turned 35 years old. Okay, happy birthday, Mark, and many, many more. Okay, so here's a brief review of what we're going to talk about today. So, I'm going to talk about applications of spectral theory and eigenfunctions, eigenvalue problems to processing of data sets. We'll have some numerical problems mentioned very rapidly. And I also want to make some comments on SVD singular value decompositions. Others of you may know this as principal components analysis. I'll review that. And multi-scale. And the reason I want to do this is in 2007, it's extremely fashionable to dump on principal components analysis and say, well, that's what they did in the last century. And if you ask them, what do you mean by that? They say, oh, I mean the 1800s. Okay? But I don't think this is entirely justified, and I'll try and draw some pictures. And then I want to make some proposals of possible fusion methods between spectral theory, multi-scale SVD, and a little bit of physics, actually, here. So there's something that's in the background for today, which is diffusion geometry. So I guess Rafi Koifman will be giving a talk on this later. His may be the first, and it was intended originally that I would give my talk after his, and therefore this is literally the cart before the horse, right? So I'm going to show you the cart today. The horse, which is pulling a lot of this, will only be partially cleansed. Okay. So let's start very slowly here because it's early in the morning and I really am jet lagged. So if you have any questions, please just stick up your hands or yell. So what's in the background of this? It's the Laplace operator. So in two dimensions, at least I learned as a freshman physics major that the world's most important equation is solving the Laplacian, and you take second derivatives with respect to the variables and you add them up. But when I became a card-carrying mathematician, I learned that you're supposed to put a minus sign in front of it because that makes the Laplacian a positive operator. And then there's a Hilbert space associated to it, and you get very happy. So the reason there's a minus sign is the corresponding object on a graph is the identity operator minus an averaging operator. And here what you do is at the node in the graph, you average over the neighbors, and you're given some weights in order to do this. So that explains the minus sign, or rather why they both have the same sign. And finally, I want to use, instead of integrals, because I'll be talking about probabilities of various outliers, and so on a data set, if we had capital N points in a data set, we could take the expectation operator, which is just, so this is E of a function F. So I have a function F, and I just sum the values and divide by the number of points. Okay, so let's take a very rapid review of eighth grade. Actually, in the United States, I guess it's first year in college. So we're on the unit circle, and we have the usual coordinates given to us, the Cartesian coordinates x comma y, and then one learns that a nice way to represent x and y is that since the radius is 1, it's backwards, of course. Okay, sorry, this is jet lag, actually. I did this for me at, I can't remember what hour in the morning. So it's cosine theta, sine theta. But this is actually still a good, this is actually a great example because I might reorder these two things. So maybe I did that on purpose. And this is a coordinate system of Laplace eigenfunctions. Let's see what this means. So here, now I haven't made a mistake. If you're on the two sphere in three space, consider the coordinate system x, y, z, the usual one. Well, the sphere has a Laplacian on it. It's called the Laplace-Beltrami operator for the sphere. And by gumbo, those three functions are the first non-trivial eigenfunctions. Let's go a little further. Okay, so let's now go to the unit interval. So we have the usual piano wire picture. So these are the functions sine and theta, and you have the fundamental frequency, which is that's sine pi x, and it starts. Goes to 1, and these are eigenfunctions because the second derivative of that function is minus n squared pi squared sine n pi x. Okay, so but since we put a minus sign in front of the second derivative, we get the eigenvalues are n squared pi squared, and I just want to comment now. Then we have a beautiful coordinate system here that we can see. So what do I mean by this? Well, let's see, if I go from, so here's a half, this is a rather strange way to build a coordinate system. Let's go to a third. Then the function sine pi x is a one-to-one mapping of 0, 1, 3rd to an interval that is approximately of length 1, not exactly, but almost. And the derivative, which is pi cosine pi x, is bounded above by pi, and it's also bounded below. And therefore, this looks like a linear function. It's some sort of C2 perturbation of a linear function, and it blows up about a third of the interval to unit size. Now, if we try to use this as a, just look at the top piece here, this, if we try to use this as a coordinate system on 0, 1, it doesn't work because the mapping is not 1 to 1, right? It's even if we reflect around the point 1 half. So we get a 2 to 1 mapping, and this does not provide a coordinate chart. And there's another bad problem, which is here, the derivative of sine is 0. And so we couldn't possibly use this as a nice coordinate system. And if we go over here, however, we can see that this guy, where we have now 2 sine of 2 pi x, that's a good place. So the derivative of this is not 0 near here. And so we've gotten a nice coordinate system. Let's take one leap of faith further. So let's look down at one of these guys. So you're seeing on the top plus times sine, and on the bottom you're seeing minus times sine. So you're supposed to think of how this overtone is being generated by the sixth eigenfunction. And if we look right here, so forgetting the 6 and the pi, the derivative of this sine function is 1 right there. And by golly, it goes from minus 1 up to plus 1 here. So it's taken a very small interval, and it's blown it up to size 1 without really any distortion. This is simply a dilation followed by, that means a multiplying by some constant lambda, times a, composed with a nice C2 perturbation of the identity. So it's now a fun exercise in baby number theory to see that for any point and any radius less than half the distance to the boundary of the piano, there is a nice local coordinate chart that blows that small interval up to unit size almost in a distortionless fashion. Okay, we'll make a slightly more technical description here. Okay. So here's an example of two dimensions that have nothing to do with dimension 2. And you may wonder why your data set, your linguistic data set, for example, is a two-dimensional object. Let's hop over that for a minute. But let's just take this example. So if we have a ball centered at x of radius r, what would that be? It would be a system. So in other words, just two functions, f of z and g of z, so that when you take z in this ball and take the image, that it's mapped over to f of z, g of z. Let's draw a picture of that. So we have some small ball, and now we have some functions, and we blow it up, and in the picture, I'd like to blow it up maybe to size about 1. So I want a notion of low distortion, and so early in the morning, let's not make a technical definition. But here's what it means. We want to map a ball to something that looks like a unit ball. And all we do is we just blow it up. We just blow it up uniformly by multiplying by some number. And then we follow that by a C2 perturbation of a rotation. So we might have this rotated exactly as I had switched sine and cosine. So that's actually a nice system. Everyone clear on what the definition is? Because
the Z is in the small ball.
Yeah, so Z is in the small ball. Here's Z. It's a very small Z, right? You can barely see it. And then we blow it up to F of Z, comma, G of Z. And so this is exactly a microscope. You've taken some very small object, you've looked at your microscope, and you've blown it up to the size that your eye recognizes as being unit size, and your lens is not absolutely perfect. There's slight there's a slight warping of the image going on, but it's not so severe. So you only get headache if you're a professor and the graduate students understand it perfectly. Okay, is that clear? Not the part about the graduate students. Okay. Okay, so of course Euclid knew about eigenfunction coordinates. He didn't differentiate, but he certainly knew about sine theta, cosine theta. See, once again here I've rotated them politely for you. But here is a nice mathematical statement. So there's no real rotation. Let's just take the normalized eigenfunctions on the circle. So first of all, the second derivative of this guy is, of the sine, is minus n squared theta, and that means the eigenfunction, the eigenvalue is n squared, because we're supposed to put a minus sign in, and same with cosine. And now I'm going to normalize them by putting in a factor of minus 1/2. And this is a good local coordinate system for any interval of length less than pi over 4. So let's just draw that picture. So that's the statement, simply, that if I take any point theta naught on the circle and any arc of length less than pi over 4, then I can choose pi of minus 1/2, either sine of n theta or cosine of n theta, depending upon the point. And it blows it up to an interval whose length is approximately 1. And this looks like a linear mapping. Proof. Sine squared theta plus cosine squared theta equals 1. And therefore, I would pick a place where the cosine squared is large and use sine, or if sine is large, one of them squared has to be bigger than 1/2, then I would use cosine. And so then it's just an easy exercise here. And why the pi to the 1/2? Because I'm normalizing in L2, so I have in the background an object which could be a point set, and then this would be just, say, averaging over the point set or summing over the point set. And here, if we have a domain, I would just integrate the square of the function, and I want it to be 1. And the reason for this is called Fourier analysis. That's because if you have a function, you can write f of theta as a sum of the inner products. That's just integrating f against pi to the minus 1/2. And then I have either sine or cosine and theta, and then I just, that's a number, and then I put in pi to the minus 1/2. And theta, and Fourier figured out but did not know how to prove that this actually helped you recover a nice function, right? So it's actually amazing. If you look back at Fourier's work, he had no idea why this formula held. And but he claimed that he had a reason. He actually did. And it took about 20 years for the proof to get written. So, quick eigen review now. Okay, now we really have an object. This is a truth in advertising symbol. Okay, that must mean that there's a slight lie which could be fixed if you pin me down. Okay, so on a good object, which could be a compact manifold, a domain, a Euclidean space, a graph, let's assume we have finite volume, which for a data set is extremely natural. And then there's a complete orthonormal basis of what of a Hilbert space L2, and of eigenfunctions, and we have for the eigenfunction, the Laplacian of the kth eigenfunction is some number, lambda k, times the function itself, and that's a global statement. And quick review, if there's a boundary, then we would say phi is a Dirichlet eigenfunction if phi vanishes on the boundary, and for Neumann, the normal derivative would be zero on the boundary, and the reason that there's a little star here is you have to be just a little bit careful about technical statements about reproducing functions, arbitrary functions, in this sense when you're in the Neumann condition, and this is because strange things can happen in spectral theory, but you have to make really nasty looking places. And for Dirichlet, which is basically the reason the spectral theorem was invented, you have a similar formula here where you just have the kth eigenfunction and you have kth eigenfunction there. And you could reproduce any reasonable function. So here's an eigenfunction. So this is the stadium, which is, I guess, that way. If you walk far enough, you'll come to the UCLA stadium. The football team is only so-so this year. They got blown out in their first game, but somehow managed to eke out a victory over the weekend. This is an eigenfunction. This is a really strange-looking eigenfunction. And it turns out that people don't really know everything about eigenfunctions, even on extremely simple domains. So if you're an aficionado motto of what's called quantum scarring, where things, there are lots of open questions, they're complicated, and this indicates a numerical challenge we'll see later. Okay, so now very brief discussion of diffusion geometry, and so then there is a statement here. Let's forget the statement, and I'll show some pictures. And there's a method which has been empirically noticed to work, and the question is, why does it work? So what is the problem? Let's now come to an example. So we have a data set, maybe of 10,000 or 100,000 documents. And we wish to learn some simple structure that this may have. And how might we do that? Well, we might embed first the individual documents in Euclidean space by attaching various features to them and using these features, word counts, n-grams, things like this. And we might embed our documents, say, in dimension 5,000, and then we want to look at them. And then, if you have documents and you come from the pentaflex era, as I did, how many of you know what pentaflex is? Wow, right. So you know, I've just revealed myself as a complete dinosaur. So let me tell you what pentaflex, I used to be in charge of pentaflex folders at some point in my life. How would you arrange a collection of documents? So here they are, they're scattered through space. So first obvious statement is the chairman of a department does not arrange anything. Okay, so they're simply just sitting there. And then someone has to come in and and arrange them. So how would you do this? Well, you might do it by local affinity. So you might say, well, you know, these guys are sort of near each other. They form some sort of cluster. Not obvious how you would find it, but you might have some clusters like this on low scale, and that could be a folder. So you put things in a folder, you declare, rightly or wrongly, that things in the folder are approximately the same, and but of course there's some arbitrary notion you've used, which is you've sort of defined a scale, because you put these in and you're saying, well, you know, two things are close in maybe the Euclidean metric and the space to put it on, or maybe we haven't even got a Euclidean space, we just have embedded this in some graph, and we'd like to go one step further. So then we would like to do the following. So for example, maybe we're supposed to arrange them like this way, so we have two different bookcases, so they're folder holders, right? So they're bookcases as well. And what are they? They're file cases. So that's a file case. Here's another file case. And we may have any more. And then we would like to group those again, because maybe there's some relation we wish to discover. So then we would put them in a room. And then we would go one step further, and we'd put different rooms in a building, and then we'd put different buildings on different campuses, etc. And we could build up some sort of hierarchical structure, and perhaps refer back and easily check out where things are and how they're related. So what I'm now going to show you is a super rapid introduction to diffusion geometry. Yes?
I still don't know what pentaflex is.
Oh, that's a great question. So pentaflex folders are green. They're green. It turns out they basically must be green. And they're simply paper folders. They have wires going along them, and you can hang them in these little cages. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's okay, because my PhD thesis was actually done with an IBM ball, with a little thing, and you needed seven different balls for the different alphabets. And that also has disappeared. So you would put these green folders in these little cages, and you'd actually get a drawer, and then the drawer would lie in a file case. The file case had a lock. The chairman didn't know how to open it up, but the secretary did, and then they were stored in rooms, and then etc. I'm sure Google Image can find the picture very, very rapidly. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to allow the data to represent itself, put itself into these various structures at various levels, and this is what I would call the lowest level type of operation. And then you would like to know, for example, if in your data set there are objects that are separated at some scale, here at unit scale, and maybe the objects here are really different. And you might be able to figure this out by associating some collection of eigenfunctions, ij1, ij2, to this one, and maybe other eigenfunctions here. So how, first of all, now they're scanning me. okay. another talk. Okay, so here's the idea behind diffusion geometry. So we have some sets. So think of this as a collection of documents, for example, that you wish to order. And now you want to have a notion of distance between the two. These are just embedded here in, oh, they could be the two-dimensional plane or a three-space. And you have a couple balls. And here we have a little bottleneck connecting them. And you'd like to measure the distance from this document to that one versus the distance from B to C. And there are two ways to do it. One, you could look at some sort of geodesic distance. You could see how long the shortest path is. And then these two documents, A and B, appear to be at about the same distance from C, but not from the point of view of a random walker. It turns out a random walker is a dual object to the Laplacian. And we can start walking randomly from A and see if we get to C. So of course we start walking around, but we're going to have a very tough time getting in the bottleneck. So it'll take quite a long time for a walker to diffuse over here. Whereas here, there are lots of paths that lead from B to C, and it's unlikely that we're going to escape through the bottleneck. So we'll diffuse over here in rather short time. So then the short story is that this might be a clever idea. Here is a data set which is a dumbbell, as in the governor of California, what he lifts every morning. And these are three base eigenfunctions for a Laplace operator there. And if we use these three eigenfunctions as calculated by Stefan Lafon, our picture looks like an elongated dumbbell, and that means that it's hard to walk from one side to the other. So this bottleneck has now presented itself in this new coordinate system. So the new coordinate system, let's just repeat what it is. We take first eigenfunction, second eigenfunction, third eigenfunction, three. We get three numbers for each point, phi 1 of x, phi 2 of x, phi 3 of x, and then a point, which might be there, gets mapped over to a point there. And we have a new presentation of the data set. And notice here there's a natural division into folders. There are clearly two folders, the stuff in here, the stuff in here, and then there's a little bit of stuff in the middle. We don't know quite what that is. OK, so we'll get some more examples. Here is, it's kind of an interesting problem. It's not the world's greatest, but just for the purposes of today's talk. So many of you have probably seen this, but this is an example where one takes 1,000 science news articles from different categories, and here they are. They are anthropology, astronomy, social sciences, earth sciences, biology, math, medicine, physics. And then we compute about 1,000 coordinates, and the ith coordinate is given by frequency of some words. So you have some collection of words. And now, instead of doing something like this mechanically, we set up a Laplace operator. And the Laplace operator is some sort of identity minus an averaging operator. So let's write this down. Laplace is identity minus averaging. So you have some weights which indicate how likely it is you walk from one point to another. And you normalize these weights so that you get an averaging operator. And now you get lots of eigenfunctions for this Laplacian. And in the right-hand picture, one picked the third, fourth, and fifth eigenfunction. On the right picture, eigenfunctions 4, 5, and 6. This is a good place for me to stop, because this is really one of the main points I wanted to make. Do you understand what is being done here physically? Please ask if you don't. someone is lying. I'm sure there's someone who's lying. So let me repeat again. We pick some eigenfunctions. That's the first problem. How do I know which eigenfunctions to pick? Well, first I would have to calculate them. Even that is a problem. It turned out to be not so trivial numerically, but here it's not so bad. And notice that we are doing this calculation in 1,000 dimensions, which is really not so bad, because we have only 1,000 points, and so this turns out to be a fairly rapid calculation. But in any case, we just get some eigenfunctions. So we could order them by lambda 1 less than or equal to lambda 2. These are all positive. And then we just start experimenting to see which ones give us some useful representation. So
is it the other way around, 10,000 equals 1,000 coordinates?
Oh, I'm sure I'm missing a zero. That's 1,000 and 10,000. And 10 is in 10,000 coordinates. You, sir, very good question. I know the following attributes of you. You are one data point, and yet you are extremely clever, handsome, violently athletic, outgoing, own a beautiful red Ferrari, and I know thousands of positive attributes of you. So you are, let's see, we're in like, I guess we're way out there. But you're out there in a very large dimensional space. It's just a list of attributes. Yes?
You can think about the Webster dictionary, how many words are there. That's your dimensionality. But you don't think about many, many words.
No, please ask. It's a good question. So he's also the only one willing to ask a question. Yeah, so go ahead.
So you can always just, when you form this Laplacian, you want to have an M by N matrix.
Oh, that's very different. Right. The matrix is N by N. But how do I assign the weights? They should depend upon the 10,000 coordinates. Okay, so once I build the weights, yes, I agree.
Oh, so you mean coordinates before the embedding?
That is Albert.
Okay. Okay. So not these coordinates that we see, the diffusion coordinates. So talk about the original coordinates.
The original coordinates are 10,000 coordinates. Another question. Yes.
So how do you measure the use coordinates of a given eigenfunction?
And that is a very good question. The usefulness is determined by an expert. Okay. Now, this is not actually, well, maybe it is, but I'll try to defend the statement there. I was going to say it's not an obnoxious answer because very often you don't know what you are looking for. So maybe I could show you offline, for example, the following interesting problem. You are given several thousand mutual funds. You know some characteristics of them. And now you want to know how similar some of them are to each other. So the problem itself is not exactly well formed, and even experts on classifications of mutual funds will argue violently about how alike they are. This is a method that is in some sense like Switzerland. It refuses to fight with the experts. It just presents evidence. And what's quite surprising is that, for example, for mutual funds, you would think it would be a very easy problem to classify mutual funds. They're on the order of, I can't remember, 8,000 mutual funds. And then it turns out to be very hard. Is it a value fund? Is it world growth? Is it And you might learn something from this. So that's why this is intended to be a level zero method, because all it's going to do is give you some sort of nonlinear coordinate system, which you then might use for the purposes you have. Okay? Let me give you another example from physics. Suppose you are a large protein and you wish to start folding around, okay? So the state space of the folding motion of a large protein is about dimension gazillion. It's really, really big. And the description of this state space through what I would call 19th century physics is you look at Lagrangians and Hamiltonians and you discover there's some manifold, and motion along this manifold is somehow representative or exactly representative of what's going on, but you cannot find it or use it for prediction. So what you would like to do is say, well, I have a three-dimensional snapshot I can take of it in a very strange nonlinear coordinate system, and in there I could easily see the motion of the molecule in terms of some vector field. So that's the type of answer that is supposed to be given by these methods. Let me now think out, okay? And go back here. Sorry. Okay, so let's start ending, and here's the theorem. Okay, so we have an object we wish to study, and we want the spectral theorem. We want spectral theory to tell us something about the geometry of this object. So here's the theorem, which is the justification, in my opinion, for these spectral type methods. So this is a theorem which is not about data sets. However, one can prove in certain cases that the corresponding theorem holds for data sets. So we take a domain in Euclidean space, a manifold, and we make the volume 1, and we have now some Laplacian on this object. And the statement is the Laplacian eigenfunctions call what one could name as a universal coordinate system on embedded balls. So what does that mean? It means that we have, for example, a manifold or a domain. We pick a ball that's embedded in the manifold, and then we go searching through these collections of eigenfunctions. Now these eigenfunctions seem to have no connection to the geometry. These are just objects that appear for a differential operator. But let's hold our breath and dive in. So we pick this ball, and then the statement is that if our object is dimension D, here it's 2, then we can find D of these eigenfunctions. For example, in this picture, 2 of them, they're not the first and second eigenfunctions. They depend on the point and the ball, and they blow up this picture to unit size at least with low distortion. So again, let me not give a super technical definition here, but the point is, if you pick, in this picture, if the object is two-dimensional, if you pick a ball, there's a microscope, and the microscope is low distortion. When you look in here, through the microscope, we'll tell you, are there two functions that happen to be these L2 normalized eigenfunctions. They will blow it up, this ball, to unit size. Actually, technically, they only blow up the central approximately 1/2. And there's an eigen rule which can be computed basically by calculus, that the size of the eigenvalue has to look like the radius to the power minus 2. So these eigenfunctions, in a certain sense, find the manifold, and the constants here don't really depend on anything. So these are just sort of universal constants given by mathematics. So they're distortion constants, they're all sorts of constants here, but they have nothing to do really with which object you're looking on. They're just the same in all cases. Yes?
Yes. So this lambda k is about the order of r 1 over r squared.
Right.
So the small regions, you need more higher frequency eigenfunctions. But my question is, what is the intuition, physical interpretation of r minus 2?
Here's the physical interpretation. Turns out the worst possible example for this theorem is the unit circle. So let's go to the unit circle, we'll pick an interval of length r, and now we need the following thing. So what we need is something like the derivative, and suppose it's a sine function that will work, of sine and theta, which is n cosine n theta. We need this to be of size n in absolute value, at least on this interval, because we want to blow it up to size 1. So how big could the image be? It could be about n times r. And if we want that to be 1, then we need n looks like r to the minus 1. And the eigenvalue of this is n squared, which looks like r to the minus 2. So that turns out it's just a very simple wavelength calculation. And surprisingly, this is the worst possible example, the unit circle. You would think that some horrible manifold might be worse. Okay, let's see. I think I will just make a very rapid statement about SVD. Oh, no, let's go back here. Let me talk about some other questions. Sure, Gunnar.
Is there a way of finding the degree of eigenfunctions? You have to compute all the first one over r squared and test them.
Okay, so now let me tell you the first coordinate that I attached to Gunnar, and that is that he is an extremely clever numerical analyst, and we don't know how to do this. This is an existence theorem. Unfortunately, it says the following. It says, if you have structures in here of a certain size, like R, they will be detected by the correct collection of eigenfunctions. And now it's an enormous challenge to, one, even pound out these eigenfunctions, and that's what you are supposed to do. Actually, your graduate student is supposed to do this by December 15th. And there are ways to search. Once you've got them, it turns out that there are very simple rules of thumb that allow you to calculate which ones are the correct ones to look at. However, it's a somewhat evasive answer, so I could explain to you offline why still there is a numerical problem. And so let me just repeat one of the numerical challenges here. Fast eigenfunction solvers are really not something that we have access to at this point. It takes a long time to pound these out, and it's a miracle that in many cases you only need the lower eigenfunction. So if you need a rather small, if you have a large structure, it will be discovered by a low eigenvalue, and then you can reasonably do it. Yes?
How do you find little d?
Oh, how do you find little d? So that, of course, is another question. If you have a data set, you have to decide what little d is. Now I'm really going to cop out by saying, oh, that's the second part of my lecture. So let me go through it like this and say that what's not generally understood is there's a multi-scale version of principal components analysis. You do some strange thing, and then it turns out that if you do a sort of non-standard multi-scale SVD theory, you calculate objects which turn out to be somehow identifiable with the total curvature at points in your data set. This then allows you to guess what D should be, because what D is really again set by the user. You might look at it, see if there are two eigenfunctions or three eigenfunctions, and I don't have really a good answer. So the ultimate cop-out is the last slide with fancy names, and this is unfortunately a very tough theorem that there's some theory about how to use multi-scale SVD in a provably sharp fashion to fit manifolds. So here I would really have to go offline with people. Let me just say there is some multi-scale version of SVD that allows you to do something like manifold learning, in that you're given a data set, it's presented in Euclidean space, and you want to find a good n-dimensional manifold where you fix the n, and then if you have certain things that look like a free energy being small, then you can fit a manifold very close to a large portion of the data set, and the volume of this manifold is also controlled by A, and everything is sharp. So what we don't have here is a fusion at this point with the spectral methods that I was talking about, but here's the interesting thing from a numerical point of view. Oh, yeah. This calculation runs at the speed of light. If there's no cursive dimension, even so, if you're in 10,000 variables, who cares? The thing just flies. And it's basically just as fast as doing one SVD on your data set. Okay, but so now, let me go back here and end there, because